welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and so many things to go through. In your appeal to heaven, make sure you continue to learn and understand, you know, what we need to restore regarding the Constitution, because if you don't know, you know, how bad the problem is, and you don't know how what we need to replace this bad government with the proper government, so that way you can actually be more effective in, one, your prayer and in your actions. So anyway, learn, pray, and act. There you go. So as I've been, I just haranguing, I'm just going to be simple because yesterday I really dove into holding people accountable. That's, if there's any purpose that the Department of Justice would be used for, is to basically prosecute those who violate Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And that's where our campaigns need to come in, because our campaigns need to be driving the fact that these public servants who are not supporting the Constitution per their oath, they need to go, period. That is the crux of the problem. Now, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we are still covering the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And we've kind of made it all the way into August 10th. I have no idea how long we've been doing this. It's been a few weeks, right? So we probably, as I look at this, I'm going to just kind of peruse. I'll peruse while you're kind of reading. But I think we may have a couple more weeks left to go, this week, next, and so forth. Anyway, where we're picking up today, folks, is we're picking up on August 10th, so scroll down to August 10th, and we're starting right at the very top with Mr. Pinckney, and it's about property and umpires and such. So let's go ahead and dive in, and actually there's this little red note that's worth kind of highlighting, so we'll, if I don't interrupt you beforehand, we probably want to stop and
okay.
And look at that. All right. Thank you.
Okay. The committee, as he had conceived, were instructed to report the proper qualifications of property for the members of the national legislature, instead of which they have referred the task to the national legislature itself. Should it be left on this footing, the first legislature will meet without any particular qualifications of property. And if it should happen to consist of rich men, they might fix such qualifications as may be too favorable to the rich. If of poor men, an opposite extreme might be run into. He was opposed to the establishment of an undue aristocratic influence in the Constitution, but he thought it essential that the members of the legislature, the executive, and the judges should be possessed of competent property to make them independent and respectable. It was prudent, when such great powers were to be trusted, to connect the tie of property with that of reputation in securing a faithful administration. The legislature would have the fate of the nation put into their hands. The president would also have a very great influence on it. The judges would have not only important causes between citizen and citizen, but also where foreigners are concerned. And here's the red part. They will even be the umpires between the United States and individual states, as well as between one state and another.
Okay, so they're not gods or demigods or what. That red line is speaking to the judges, the federal courts. In other words, there to be an umpire between the states. When it comes to jurisdiction of the state, the Constitution, even though they were still pounding it out and trying to make sure, you know, everything just kind of made sense, the problem was that the states kind of rejected this idea that the federal court would have jurisdiction between, a citizen of a different state and a state. In other words, when somebody wanted to kind of hold a state accountable, they would get the federal government into check, or basically giving them jurisdiction. The 11th Amendment removed that, as well as dealing with a foreigner and a state. So as we kind of look at what they're talking about here, one of the things that kind of states the importance, because they start off identifying who has the fate of the nation, the legislature, in other words, Congress. Our representatives have the fate of the nation. The president would also have a very great influence on it, but that's it. The legislature does not have to listen to the president if he's going down the wrong direction. They have the responsibility of impeaching him. And they've never done that with all of the tyrants that we've had. Obama got a complete pass. Biden got a pass. This is because we have completely abandoned the constitutions and the limited government and the requirement of supporting it. That's just how important getting back to supporting the Constitution is. So, okay, and we already talked about the judges being the umpires. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Were he to fix the quantum of property which should be required, he should not think of less than $100,000 for the president, half of that sum for each of the judges, and in like proportion for members of the national legislature. He would, however, leave the sums blank. His motion was that the president of the U.S., the judges, and the members of the legislature should be required to swear that they were respectively possessed of a cleared, unencumbered estate to the amount of blank in the case of the president, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so Mr. Rutledge then pipes in. Now, you got to remember, Mr. Pinckney, the guy that's basically asserting this, is from the South, where land is king. They have all of the affluence in the southern states. They're basically, as it was pointed out, I think Thomas Sowell pointed this out, that when the southern states decided to go to war and to secede from the Union, there were 900 men that was representing the different plantations or the franchised plantations of the South. And they chose to send millions of Southerners. These weren't elected people. These were people that basically believed they had the most say because they had the most money.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, these 900 families, if you really think about it, and had this been discovered at the time that these 900 families really wanted to go down this path. Now, keep in mind, the South had a right to secede from the Union because they were being attacked. But these 900 families that basically was going to, well, you know what, let me back up. How did they even imagine that Lincoln was going to drag him into war? I mean, that was all on Lincoln. So I will stop myself before I said it, and I'm glad I did, because really, even though these 900 men decided for, you know, they should have at least in the Confederation, unless the Confederation assumed an aristocracy or that gave that level of control to those men, then, you know, they should have been held accountable. Or I should say the government and those people that said, okay, that's what we're going to do, because the southern state legislatures started writing secession notes or secession letters. And by the fourth one, Lincoln said, that's it. I'm not accepting anymore. I'm going to shut down Congress so we don't get any. They can't leave the Union because Congress won't be in session. Mm-hmm. Like, that makes sense, right? So anyway, let's move on with Mr. Rutledge. Another Southerner whose paradigm is land is king. Go ahead.
Mr. Rutledge seconded the motion, observing that the committee had reported no qualifications because they could not agree on any among themselves, being embarrassed by the danger on one side of displeasing the people by making them high, and on the other of rendering them nugatory by making them low.
Okay, so the committee basically had its hands tied because they didn't want to go one way or the other. And so the question is, you know, why is it low when you think about, you know, if it's a representative government, it should be able to, you know, represent, or any person should be able to become a representative. Again, the thought of maintaining a bloodline and or something that's based on your property, because the shenanigans would step in. The bloodlines would protect their property and make sure that the other bloodlines wouldn't be able to obtain property. They would seize control. I mean, it's a dangerous game that they were playing, or the Southerners were trying to play. So,
Nowadays, I think it's switched, and they think they have to be a lawyer, or they have to be, you know, somebody highly educated.
Well, actually, to become a representative in the House of Representatives, you have to be 25 years of age and 7 years of citizen. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And a senator, 35 years of age, and a citizen for 10 years. That's it. So they made it so that anybody could, even an immigrant, a proper immigrant. Anyway, because we got Ilhan Omar or whatever, these Mohammedans that are in office, they should never have been allowed to become citizens. They should never have been allowed to become citizens. I mean, if you have an honest discussion, it is impossible for them to be faithful in their faith and be able to support the Constitution as the supreme law of the land.
Right.
So,
yeah.
How is it that they, you know, get this passed to lie in their citizenship? Anytime that the words Sharia law, or we don't like this form of government, anytime those, I mean, I don't want to say you can't have dissent, but when you reject our form of government, our Republican form of government, a constitutional republic, then, you know, why are you even a citizen? Oh, well, I want to be a citizen so I can, you know, undermine you and actually destroy your government. That's why.
Yeah.
So, okay. Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut brings a little bit of a different perspective, I'm sure.
Mr. Ellsworth, the different circumstances of different parts of the U.S. and the probable difference between the present and future circumstances of the whole render it improper to have either uniform or fixed qualifications. Make them so high as to be useful in the southern states, and they will be inapplicable to the eastern states. Suit them to the latter, and they will serve no purpose in the former. In like manner, what may be accommodated to the existing state of things among us may be very inconvenient in some future state of them. He thought for these reasons that it was better to leave this matter to the legislative discretion than to attempt to a provision for it in the Constitution.
And interestingly enough, it is one of the things that didn't even give it legislative discretion. In other words, it became a standard, not a power. In other words, it didn't go into Article 1, Section 8 that they could regulate these standards, which is a good thing. Yeah. Very good thing. So, okay, so Benjamin Franklin pipes in with his providence or wisdom.
Dr. Franklin expressed his dislike of everything that tended to debase the spirit of the common people. If honesty was often the companion of wealth, and if poverty was exposed to peculiar temptation, it was not less true that the possession of property increased the desire of more property. Some of the greatest rogues he was ever acquainted with were the richest rogues. We should remember the character which the scripture requires in rulers, that they should be men hating covetousness. The Constitution will be much read and attended to in Europe, and if it should betray great Partiality to the rich will not only hurt us in the esteem of the most liberal and enlightened men there, but discourage the common people from removing into this country.
Okay, so it seems like we're going through a very similar conversation that we've already covered, right? So Franklin, Madison, they're all going to come up with these things that, you know, this is what they need to be. They need to be this particular type of person. They need to have this much affluence. And as you go through the votes, they continue to fail because they... They finally have it at this point in time, come to an agreement. And so, folks, it's worth reading the rest of this, but I think it's more important that we kind of move on and go down to the next matter of importance that we want to share. And that would be on Saturday, August 18th. And this is where the admission of new states and, you know, patents and so forth. Because actually, if I remember correctly, didn't we kind of cover this?
Feels like we did.
I think we did, because the grant of charters of corporations and so forth. The militia, did we start reading the militia? I believe we did. I think we covered these things already. And so, as we jump down to the next militia, Mr. Garrett, check here against standing armies of peace. Okay, we kind of covered that as well. So the next militia on August 21st. And I want to say that where we are now is the property and the compromise. And so let's go to August 22nd.
Okay.
And this is where they make the compromise, because I don't think Madison maybe covered it as well as the I'll just say the fists started flying. Actually, it wasn't a brawl, but the tempers of many really got hot. Mm-hmm. And so let's start off with Mr. Sherman, and then we'll dive into what Mr. Mason says. Go ahead. Now, remember, we kind of read something, and I'm not sure if it was Sherman, I think it was somebody else from Connecticut, that had a very unsavory position regarding slavery, that now Mason is going to kind of echo that. So let's go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Sherman was for leaving the clause as it stands. He disapproved of the slave trade, yet as the states were now possessed of the right to import slaves, as the public good did not require it to be taken from them, and as it was expedient to have as few objections as possible to the proposed scheme of government, he thought it be best to leave the matter as we find it. He observed that the abolition of slavery seemed to be going on in the U.S., and that the good sense of the several states would probably by degrees complete it. He urged on the convention the necessity of dispatching its business.
Okay, so this is the start of the day. In other words, this is where they kind of left off. And as I look up above in the comments before, there's nowhere where they talk about slavery, but they do talk about freemen. And so, again, I think that this they dove into this because it was the water cooler conversation, or, you know, their tea and coffee conversation before they really started, you know, having their prayer and getting to work. Okay, so Mr. Mason, go ahead and let's read these points.
Colonel Mason, this infernal traffic originated in the avarice of British merchants. The British government constantly checked the attempts of Virginia to put a stop to it. The present question concerns not the importing states alone, but the whole Union. The evil of having slaves was experienced during the late war. Had slaves been treated as they might have been by the enemy, they would have proved dangerous instruments in their hands. But their folly dealt by the slaves as it did by the Tories. He mentioned the dangerous interactions of the slaves in Greece and Sicily, and the instructions given by Cromwell to the commissioners sent to Virginia, to arm the servants and slaves in case other means of obtaining its submission should fail. Maryland and Virginia, he said, had already prohibited the importation of slaves expressly. North Carolina had done the same in substance. All this would be in vain if South Carolina and Georgia be at liberty to import.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. The one thing that he mentioned was the avarice at the very beginning. And so the word, I think you called it avarice, but it's avarice. It is greed. That's the word for greed. And actually, if I look up the synonym for it, yeah, greed, greediness, materialism, covetedness, acquisitionativeness. Anyway, so this is why, and I wanted to stop before we got into this next one, this next little powerful thing he says, because bottom line, it is this greed of the Southerners, more land, more control, more land, more control. They were creating, in essence, when the king got opposed for the first time as England was trying to create its own monarchy, because there have been many times where monarchs were inserted into England, and the people of Britain just weren't going to have it. So King John was opposed. Who opposed him? The land barons, the men who were in control of the serfs, the peasants, and those people living in their dwellings and communities. Many of them had, you know, become somewhat educated and had, you know, some affluence, more than the peasant and more than the serf, more than the slave. But for the most part, there were 25 land barons that drew swords on King John and said, we're not going to have this anymore. And it was, in a way, they were doing it for themselves, but they wanted to include the rights of the Englishmen. I mean, when you really think about it, at that point in time, the intentions were good by the land barons. As we look at what the South was doing, it was literally doing it not because it was for the betterment of the people, the liberty of the people, and so forth. It was contrary to that. And so we can kind of see how the land barons in America wanted to move forward with, you know, taking more control of America. And they believed, because they held so much money, because they were mass producers, because they were using slavery, you know, to produce the tobacco and so forth. And, you know, tobacco was really a wretched industry because it destroyed the soil. I mean, one crop of tobacco would deplete the soil. You really couldn't hardly grow anything on it for a few years, 7 or something like that. But anyway, as we get ready to go into this next part, I just wanted to help set the stage that there, you know, Mason is talking about this greed that is trying to, you know, get a stronger footing and move forward. And they're trying to get themselves advantages in this government. So go ahead and pick it up from where you left off. I think the Western people are already calling out for the slaves. Yeah.
If the Western people are already calling out for slaves for their new lands and will fill that country with slaves if they can be got through South Carolina and Georgia. Slavery discouraged arts and manufacturers. The poor despise labor when performed by slaves. They prevent the immigration of whites, really enrich and strengthen the country.
Okay, so Tammy's completely unaware that, and I was unaware that we were going into a break. But as we come back, we'll pick it up from right where she left off regarding the discouragement of manufacturers. So the poor despise the labor. We'll pick it up from right there, folks. So don't worry. We will be right back after this. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so actually, it was kind of convenient that we had this interruption. And so, as you started going down this path, Mason already pointed out the obvious. He pointed out that the Western states, now when he said the Western states, he wasn't talking about the Northwest Territory. He was specifically speaking about the Western states from the Carolinas and Georgia. In other words, the Southern West states, the Southwest states. And that they were already trying to get more slaves into those areas as well. So this is, they were really trying to expand their institution because let's think about this. I mean, if they could amass enough wealth, they could start buying up industries in the North, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing that would keep them as they started amassing. Because they're creating these franchises, they could collectively start working together in, you know, seizing more and more resources and assets of the United States. I don't think that the character of these men, or I should say, not the men here at the convention, but the men that were trying to straddle America, you know, under their control. And so we had that. We did have that. But folks, when we look at the Civil War, it was, we're talking about 900 people. That's it. It was, that's a large group, but when you consider how many people were living in the United States at the time of the Civil War, I mean, I think slave-wise, it was something like 6 to 9 million, depending on who you believe. I mean, it was still pale in comparison to Russia. Russia had 22 million. So we had, I'll just say, we had this opportunity to set the nation right. And we couldn't, so that they put it into the Constitution to hinder and stop their ability to expand slavery. Had they not had they not obtained the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the South would have just had all sorts of problems. But because they got the Missouri Compromise, there was nothing stopping them, because they were just continually forcing slavery upon these other states. And even though they couldn't, I mean, I would, because the greed was such, I believe that there was probably a market for some of these men to actually create a baby farm. Does that make sense? Because they couldn't import slaves anymore, and so they probably said, "Well, we have to have more black children born." Now, as that continued, and it continued to, I'm sure they were trying to proliferate as much as possible, because they were trying to get this institution, to take over the nation. I truly believe that was their strategy. I'd love to see somebody actually find and do that type of deep dive research where, you know, this Southern paradigm, because I know George Fitzhugh, and I mentioned this in my book, and I think I've mentioned his name before to you. George Fitzhugh, as a professor, was basically professing that all people should be slaves. In other words, what happens when a bad idea gets out there? 9 times out of 10, when somebody gives you a bad idea, it grows legs, and people try to make that happen. And so, like Obamacare, I mean, it started off with Hillary Care. It grew legs. Next thing you know, we now have this unconstitutional, monolithic, you know, healthcare system. It's the same thing with what we were seeing with slavery. And so I think that Fitzhugh was trying to help prepare the grab of bringing in all these partial landowners and poor people that just had no slaves. They couldn't compete. They couldn't do anything. And so, well, you know, we're going to legalize slavery for white people too, because now they can, you know, if you really think about it, it was almost like communism without communism.
Right.
Right. Right. Okay, so go ahead and pick it back up with the poor despised labor when performed by slaves. Go ahead. Right there.
Yeah, the poor despised labor when performed by slaves. They prevent the immigration of whites, who really enrich and strengthen a country. They produce the most pernicious effect on manners. Every master of slaves is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. As nations cannot be rewarded for punished or punished in the next world, they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes national sins by national calamities. He lamented that some of our Eastern brethren had from a lust of gain embarked in this nefarious traffic. As to the states being in possession of the right to import, this was the case with many other rights, now to be properly given up. He held it essential in every point of view that the general government should have power to prevent the increase of slavery.
Interesting. I get what he's saying, but there's one thing that actually I didn't realize is not highlighted. And he says that he lamented that some of our Eastern brethren had from a lust of gain embarked in this nefarious traffic. In other words, those people up in Massachusetts, you know, up in that area, just to make money, they were bringing slaves from Africa into the southern states.
Mm.
Ooh. I never caught that before, but having heard you read that, it jumped out. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So now we're going to hear with Mr. Ellsworth, states, as we kind of look at the Connecticut view. Go ahead.
So Mr. Ellsworth, as he had never owned a slave, could not judge of the effects of slavery on character. He said, however, that if it was to be considered in a moral light, we ought to go farther and free those already in the country, as slaves also multiply so fast in Virginia and Maryland that it is cheaper to raise than import them. Whilst in the sickly rice swamps, foreign supplies are necessary. If we go no farther than is urged, we shall be unjust towards South Carolina and Georgia. Let us not intermeddle. As population increases, poor laborers will be so plenty as to render slaves useless. Slavery in time will not be a speck in our country. Provision is already made in Connecticut for abolishing it, and the abolition has already taken place in Massachusetts. As to the danger of insurrections from foreign influence, that will become a motive to kind treatment of the slaves.
Okay, so it's interesting that there are two kind of things that come out of this. He talks about this concept that it's cheaper to raise than import them. But just think about that. In other words, you're creating a baby farm. In other words, there's going to be this investment where, you know, they're not going to have families. That's the way they would. even though at this point in time they did have families and they were breaking up families. It was all, and as a matter of fact, I believe that's what Thomas Jefferson stated in his original Declaration of Independence. The immorality of taking people away from their families. And it was stated here as well. It's interesting how Mr. Ellsworth was okay with allowing it to fester. Would they have stated the same if it was plural marriage? Would they have stated the same if it was something that would have actually been more of a religious challenge to their paradigm? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
See, because right. Slavery, not that it was embraced, as a matter of fact, not biblically embraced, because every slave owner had a jubilee. Do you know what a jubilee is? Every 7 years, or after 6 years of toil, the land and you're supposed to rest your labor. And so that was the year of the Jubilee, where the laborers were let go. And so it was up to them to determine whether they wanted to maintain their status as a laborer, slave, or not. And so it created... It was an impetus for the landowner to be one moral, of good character, of being, helping and that type of thing, to create better conditions so that when after 6 years and that laborer goes, you know what? You know, you're treating me fair. I mean, I've got my family here and we've become a laboring class for you, and it's okay because you treat us well. We love it. And so, when they, come back from the Jubilee, they are, go right back to work. And that was common. And then there was the Golden Jubilee, which I think is a more significant, change or requirement of, cutting off the away from your labor and so forth. But the point is this, is that when we looked at how it was being done, at least the divine hand of providence, the creator, required them to be, provide dignity to these people and to ensure whoever you were enslaving was, treated properly. Because if you didn't, you'd have to go find or buy more slaves after, your jubilee. Because that was the law of the land. It's the same thing when you look at, debting and so forth. It's interesting how when Israel created these standards of, you can't charge interest on debt. Well, they can if you're not Israel, if you're not a Jew, if you're not, an Israelite. And so they get away with doing that, but it's immoral to charge each other that. I mean, it's very similar to the Mohammedans, other than the fact that they're tolerant towards Christianity. I mean, they don't kill you and force you into slavery because, you're an infidel. Anyway, I digress. So let's go into Mr. Pinckney now.
Mr. Pinckney, if slavery be wrong, it is justified by the example of all the world. It is justified. Okay. If slavery be wrong, it is justified by the example of all the world. He cited the case of Greece, Rome, and other antient states, the sanction given by France, England, Holland, and other modern states. In all ages, one half of mankind have been slaves. If the southern states were let alone, they will probably of themselves stop importations. He would himself, as a citizen of South Carolina, vote for it. An attempt to take away the right as proposed will produce serious objections to the Constitution, which he wished to see adopted.
And at this point, because it is leaning towards accepting slavery, so that was at risk here. So Mr. Pinckney said that, and his brother or kin, General Pinckney, said what?
Sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, okay.
General Pinckney declared it to be his firm opinion that if himself and all his colleagues were to sign the Constitution and use their personal influence, it would be of no avail towards obtaining the assent of their constituents. South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves. As to Virginia, she will gain by stopping the importations. Her slaves will rise in value, and she has more than she wants. It would be unequal to require South Carolina and Georgia to confederate on such unequal terms. He said the royal assent before the revolution had never been refused to South Carolina as to Virginia. He contended that the importation of slaves would be for the interests of the whole Union. The more slaves, the more produce to employ the carrying trade. The more consumption also, and the more of this, the more of revenue for the common treasury. He admitted it to be reasonable that slaves should be dutied like other imports, but should consider a rejection of the clause as an exclusion of South Carolina from the Union.
Interesting, okay. So now Mr. Baldwin of Georgia, who probably took offense to what he just said, they're slinging mud at each other. Keep going. Go ahead.
Mr. Baldwin had conceived national objects alone to be before the convention, not such as like the present were of a local nature. Georgia was decided on this point. The state had always hitherto supposed a general government to be pursuant of the central states who wished to have a vortex of everything that her distance would preclude her from equal advantage, and that she could not prudently purchase it by yielding national powers. From this, it might be understood in what light she would view an attempt to abridge one of her favorite prerogatives. If left to herself, she may probably put a stop to the evil. As one ground for this conjecture, he took notice of the sect of blank, which he said was a respectable class of people who carried their ethics beyond the mere equality of men, extending their humanity to the claims of the whole animal creation.
There was some sect, and I'm going to guess maybe African, because that's what we were talking about here, that, you know, was a very respectable class of people. Anyway, it's interesting. Okay, so now Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania, right? Now he speaks up. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson observed that if South Carolina and Georgia were themselves disposed to get rid of the importation of slaves in a short time, as had been suggested, they would never refuse to unite because the importation might be prohibited. As the section now stands, all articles imported are to be taxed. Slaves alone are exempt. This is, in fact, a bounty on the article, on that article.
Okay, and now Mr. Gary, I'll go ahead and read it. Mr. Gary thought, we had nothing to do with the conduct of the states as to slaves. He's talking about whether this general government was going to be able to deal with state issues, but ought to be careful not to give any sanction to it. So in other words, maybe they shouldn't say, well, you know, go ahead and be a slave happy as you want. I think that what Mr. Gary was trying to say is that it's a state issue. You need to let them do it, but the general government cannot be condoning it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now Delaware, Mr. Dickinson steps in. Now, technically, I'm not sure if you knew this, but Delaware and Maryland and pretty much south of there, Pennsylvania not so, but Delaware and Maryland and then down to Virginia. So Pennsylvania was kind of the west, northwest of these states. That Pennsylvania was, you know, abandoning slavery, but slavery was in those three states, Maryland, Delaware, and because I remember driving up and finding cotton fields going from Norfolk across the Bay Bridge up into, I think it's Maryland, and then getting up into Delaware. You could actually see the cotton fields. And I was kind of surprised how small the cotton bushes were, but maybe it's just because they've depleted the soil. It's just not thriving well or whatever. But anyway, nevertheless, Mr. Dickinson of Delaware, go ahead.
Mr. Dickinson considered it as inadmissible on every principle of honor and safety that the importation of slaves should be authorized to the states by the Constitution. The true question was whether the national happiness would be promoted or impeded by the importation. And this question ought to be left to the national government, not to the states particularly interested. If England and France permit slavery, slaves are at the same time excluded from both those kingdoms. Greece and Rome were made unhappy by their slaves. He could not believe that the southern states would refuse to confederate on the account apprehended, especially as the power is not likely to be immediately exercised by the general government.
And I would say this, because the South was in they had a huge liability because of the slavery. If they chose not to unite and join the Union, they had the most to lose. Mm-hmm. Because nobody was going to go fight them. This is the more, a long time ago, I said, you know what, in the convention, they should have said, okay, well, grab your bags and pack them up and go ahead and leave the Union. We're okay with that. We'll move on without you. But when you come back, you're going to have to get rid of those things we call slaves. And you're going to have to free them, and you're going to have to, give them their liberty and so forth. And I honestly believe that would have avoided everything. They should have held their ground and said, that's okay, we can move forward with 10 states. Not knowing that Rhode Island was still going to be problematic, but we'll move forward with 10 states and just change the parameters from 9 states and make it, 7 states to ratify. So anyway. Right. Anyway. Okay, so Mr. Williamson of North Carolina then speaks up. Go ahead.
Mr. Williamson stated the law of North Carolina on the subject, to wit that it did not directly prohibit the importation of slaves. It imposed a duty of $5?
Probably.
Is that what it is? Mm-hmm, probably. $5 on each slave imported from Africa. That would be a lot back then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it imposed a duty of $5 on each slave imported from Africa, 10 on each from elsewhere, and 50 on each slave from a state licensing manumission.
Right. So in other words, when you bought a slave from another state, they made more money.
Right.
Right. And I think that because of the requirement of having to break the slave, right? These poor souls were just being captivated, and they were being sold into slavery by their own people. So anybody thinking otherwise, that's, they're missing the boat. So
they're saying they were of less value if they came from Africa?
Well, say the cost would be more. In other words, when you look at the different kingdoms that played and dabbled in slavery, the most desirable slave in, by the Ottoman Empire, which actually created the association of the name of Slav into slave, mm-hmm. were the Slavs of Russia. And this is because they were big, strong, and dumb. And they were easy to basically condition. And as a matter of fact, if you read Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks, White Liberals, he goes into the details of the Ottoman Empire wanted eunuchs. And in the day, what would happen is they'd take captive all of these Slavs, and they would castrate them. And then they would put them on a trail because they couldn't put them on a boat. They were up in the mountains and, out there in the lands. So they had to march them down to the Ottoman Empire. 90% of these castrated men died on that trail.
Wow.
the cost was so high, but it was the demand. In other words, they were willing to pay the cost of going up there, capturing 100 men, and only getting 10 slaves out of the harvest.
Wow.
And so the cost, again,
it's they terrible. Were,
I absolutely, this was a wretched industry. Absolutely. And so that one book, Thomas Sowell's, you know, Rednecks and White Rednecks, or you know, Black Rednecks and White Liberals, really helps people start seeing that slavery really wasn't a white or black issue. It only became a white-black issue in America because the king said it so. He was the one that mandated in 1660s that all slaves had to be black Africans, or black, period. And so, in so doing, he knew that because there was a lot of promise in America. Now, you got to remember that Spain and Portugal, while Spain was the big empire, while they had the Armada before Britain had beaten them and then took the top notch of the world empire, they left America alone because there was no gold and nothing to steal. And there wasn't a lot of people up there, you know, to enslave and so forth like they had down in South America and in Mexico, or, you know, Mexico and below. The farther north you went, the colder it got, and it was just people just didn't want to deal with that. You know, they didn't have clothes and stores and those types of things, so life was easier when you were closer to the equator because you at least could run around with hardly anything on.
Right.
And so, anyway, when we look at the fact that they left America alone, nobody realized how rich the land was for agriculture and productivity and so forth. And it really was a treasure that when England went in there, they created commerce instead of just stealing the golden riches of these former nations. And so if you look at what happened, because there was a lot of gold, a lot of gems and so forth that were stolen out of America or out of the Americas. Look at what happened to Portugal and Spain. They went bankrupt. What happened? Why did they? Because they never worked for their money. Does that make sense? Where, you know, the different model, the different paradigm with Britain, we're going to work and we're going to produce, we're going to produce, we're going to produce. And that was the model that of success, that you could become a strong, rich nation by doing that. If you kept on, you know, banking on the fact that we're going to steal from the next people we find, then then you realize that, you know, you've got a dead end. You can't just continue to steal. We're out of time as we're going down this path. So when we come back, we'll kind of pick it back up with wherever we left off, I think, Mr. Williamson. But anyway, with that, let me kind of let it go at this point. Folks, I hope this is helping, because this gives us insight as to why these decisions were being made. And these things, because the woke and the DEI and all of that are misinforming us, knowing these things, I think, gives us a lot more ammo. I'm G.R. Mobley with Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.